Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Abundant Solutions Hour. Our goal is to help others be more, do more, and have more. I'm your host, Gregory Turner.
And I'm your co-host, Brian J. Henderson.
Brian,
boy, yes,
what a long vacation.
Oh, man, I had a ball. I had an absolute ball.
Well, good. I tell you what, tonight's show is a touching show. It's we're going to talk about foster kids, foster care, and you know how that is.
Oh, yes.
You've been involved in it.
With foster kids for quite a while now, directly and indirectly. So
mm-hmm.
I do know about that, and I know how important it is. You know, even as a child, I've known people who were foster parents, who were foster children. And so
yeah.
I do know how important and just how serious an issue it is for people who are involved in, affiliated with foster care.
Yes, yes. And, Brian, our guest tonight, oh, boy, I tell you what, a lot of people will be blessed by her.
Yes, yes.
And I'll say a lot of people are going to learn a lot of things about her that they never knew.
Mm-hmm.
She's more than just a pretty face and an actress that, you know, you see on television with all the glamour and the glitz. It's more than that. It's something else that was pushing her, Brian.
Yes, yes. And, Greg, I'm going to go ahead and get her on the line. So if you just give everybody some insight on who our special guest is tonight.
No, I don't want to do that. I'm going to wait.
You don't do that yet.
I'm going to wait. I'm going to let you do that. That's your thing. But I can definitely talk about our guest. But you go ahead and you bring her in.
Okay. Stand by.
Yes. Right now, we have a caller from the 770 area code. I'm going to go to her right now. Caller, are you there?
It's Dee Stewart.
Dee.
Hey.
How are you?
Good.
Yes. I wanted to go to you really quick because we know that our guest is coming on in a few minutes, and it's going to be a powerful show, and when you saw who our guest was, I don't want you to give it out just now. I think everybody knows who's coming on, but when you saw who we were going to have on the show, what did you think?
I got excited.
I guess everybody did, but you know what? Did you know that she was raised in foster care?
Yes, I've read the book, and I
wow.
had been thinking about being a foster parent
right.
or adopting myself,
uh-huh.
so that's... just like right up my alley. So,
well, you know, Brian and I, we do a lot with kids in the detention centers and kids in group homes and foster care. It is a different kind of how do I say it without being sounding too mean or too tough, but
it is
a system that you don't want any child to be in. I'll just say it like that. Until you go in there and you see how these kids are treated.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them now, not all the time. I won't say that about all of them, but it is a system that's tough. It's and for you to want to adopt, that means you must have a love for children and a love for someone being able to just flourish and have the ability to be what God created them to be.
Well, thanks. I had a cousin who our family, she was adopted into the family. And one of my best cousins, she passed 2 years
oh.
ago from complications at pregnancy. But after, you know, growing up with her, I had always had it in the back of my mind. And since now, I don't want to. And I also had a friend in college who grew up and became a ward of the state.
Wow.
And so so I've heard, I've seen some, we've had some foster care kids come through the family, didn't do, you know, couldn't get out of whatever happened to them. And it's
right.
hard. It's
right.
hard to be a foster care parent. It's hard for a kid. And I wanted to, you know, find out information, how can it be successful, because I hear
right.
so many bad stories and people tell me no, not to do it. And
well, I tell you what, Dee, you just hold on a few minutes. We're going to bring our guest in, and I'm going to come back to you, And I want to bring Brian back in. Brian, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Yes, okay. I tell you what, Brian, tonight's show is going to be touching. Like I said before, a lot of people are going to learn a lot from our special guest tonight. Like I said before, yes. She's more than an actress. And I tell you what, Brian, she's doing some wonderful things.
Absolutely, absolutely. And tonight's guest is Victoria Roel, and she's the versatile actress of daytime, primetime, and feature film. And she's known around the world as the fiery Lucilla Winters on CBS's highly rated daytime series, The Young and the Restless. She's also the author of the book, The Women Who Raised Me, and she's celebrating the role models in her life. And I'd like to introduce her now. Are you there, Ms. Roel?
I sure am, and I just want to thank everybody there at the station and everyone who has purchased the book because it got on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's now in paperback. So I just want to thank everybody.
Yes, Ms. Roel, this is Greg Turner.
Hi, Greg.
I tell you what, you're doing some amazing things. And when I went on your site, victoriaroel.com, I saw so much. I saw just so much, and I learned so much about you. Hmm. And it was my first time. I didn't know that you were raised in a foster home. And I also read that the part about the foundation that you've created.
Yes, I started back in 90 formulating a charity that really was a template of what was offered to me growing up in foster care for the 18 years, which was women banded together. They didn't initially know each other. That means the social workers and the ballet teacher and my foster parents, and they worked together, and my foster mother's family, to make sure that I got a scholarship. They found a way to get me to ballet classes, and I offered that to the children both in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I studied as a child, and then, of course, in Los Angeles, where I live. And we provide fine arts scholarships, drama, music, dance, and also stipends for our youth, both in foster care and adopted, to attend college.
Hmm.
Wow. That's awesome. Wow, that's awesome. You know, Ms. Roel, Greg and I, we go around and we talk with youth from all walks of life, and me, myself, have had foster children live in my home, as well as I've been what's called a foster parent babysitter, so to speak, where I would assist my mother-in-law who had foster care,
mm-hmm.
who was had foster children. She may have fostered about close to 50, 60 kids.
Wow.
In the past 10 years, and so I've been heavily involved in the foster parenting. You know, in your experience in foster care, what was it like?
Well, that's a big, big question. It continues to be like that because once a foster child, you are indoctrinated in an alum of 12 million people.
Mm.
That is the registered number right now, and so it's a very big population of people, and I've never left that part of my life because I understand that that is the cornerstone of who I am and my strength. My journey was very enriching as it was challenging, and I imagine that that is the case with most foster children. Even if you are given the best of circumstances in that scenario,
mm-hmm.
So I wrote about it because it was very circuitous and it's very complicated and there's no short answer except that it was so multifaceted, I thought it warranted being made into a book. And I did the right thing because America, not only America, I've been to India and back with a book,
mm-hmm.
and just got back from St. Lucia and St. Thomas and plan to be in other parts of the world this year with the book. People want to read about the heroes like your mother and like yourself who did the excellent work in raising other people's children. We keep hearing about the negative and see those headlines in the newspapers and in the news, but people want to read about the millions of people who did the job well.
Right.
We want to read about the foster grandparents out there raising a second generation of children due to their own children, their first generation of children who have succumbed to crack cocaine or methamphetamine addiction. So they're raising a second generation of children.
Mm-hmm.
We want to hear about the grandparents out there that are spending their Social Security checks on diapers and formula and not on their medication, and they're dying trying. It's a real pandemic.
I'll tell you what.
I agree.
Yes, I applaud you for what you're doing. And Brian and I, we've been brainstorming on what we can do on our end to try to pull some of the kids out of that system.
Right.
To not to beat the system up, but to pull them out of that and to show them
sorry about
love.
The dogs in the background.
they want to be on the show, that's all.
They want to be on the show.
But what I was saying, you know, we're trying to figure out what we can do for these kids, because we go
right.
in and we teach abstinence training right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, if, and I'll say to anybody that's listening, please get involved. Volunteer an hour if you can. You will make a difference
yeah.
because these kids, they look for us to come. And when we can't come, it's they're so heartbroken.
Yeah,
and,
I mean, there are.
Yes, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that there are different ways that people can participate. There's court-appointed special advocates
mm-hmm.
where you train, and they're called CASA for short, CASAs. And they train, they do case study, home studies, and then they bring their findings to the judge. And the judge leans heavily into the findings of a CASA who has been trained and licensed.
Mm-hmm.
There's another group called, and you can go on to www.casa.com or casa.org, and also you can look up Guardian Ad Litem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another group that is trained, is licensed, and it's a real serious commitment of time. It is volunteerism, but very, very important. Not everyone can be a foster parent, and not everyone can adopt. Let's say you want to be a foster parent, but you can't do it full-time. Well, you can be a respite caregiver. That's somebody who trains, is licensed, and takes a child or sibling groups, especially important to foster care, so we don't break up the children. But they will take a sibling or sibling groups for a weekend so that the primary foster family or mother or father can take a rest. And some respite caregivers take the children up to a week or more because we don't want the 137,000 foster parents we do have to burn out. We have over 500,000 children in care right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of children and only a little over 130,000 foster parents.
Mm. Right, right. And, you know, the thing that's just so compelling is that when you do meet these foster children, they have so many different issues that they're dealing with mentally, physically, you know, emotionally, and you try to do the best you can, but, you know, not everyone is that well equipped. So, you know, what do you think are some of the things that people can do, like people who are foster parents? You know, I know you talked about respite care, you know, that gives them a break, but what are some of the other things, like, you talked about how your organization does the arts, and that's a wonderful thing. My children are heavily involved with the arts. They learn violin and dance
mm-hmm.
in the past and stuff like that. You know, but what are some of the other things that you believe that foster parents can do to give these children a fulfilling life? Because we know that they've been through so much before they actually get to that foster parent.
Right. Well, obviously faith. To teach them faith. Because they are dealing with a very sophisticated set of circumstances, and even though they might have come out of an abusive situation, home is home, and mother and daddy are who they are. And the thing about children is that they're so resilient and so forgiving. And they have to be taught that they deserve to be in a safe, healthy, and clean environment, and they are teachable and lovable, and so beyond that, of course, they need to learn how to have faith in themselves and what that looks like and what that means. And that's one of the biggest gifts. I'm the beneficiary of Agatha Wooten Armstead, who was a great-grandmother when she took me in. And she had already had 10 children, and she taught me the power of prayer. I mean, to the extent that, you know, I defined what worked for me, but that was a very important piece in my life, because when you are in foster care, you find yourself alone a lot. And what are you leaning into? Well, it's easy to lean into the wrong thing. So I want to say that that was very important to me, and she taught me discipline. I mean, we were farmers. She was a black farmer, and we really harvested land. And I'm not saying everyone is a farmer, but I'm saying that I listened to her, and the discipline of teaching me how to grow crops, harvest crops, freeze crops. I had chores, and that was very important to me as a person. It still is at the core of who I am. I had a disciplined lifestyle. And then, of course, I love ballet, and that's discipline. Beyond that, you know, I think that we have to look at the foster parents. They have to take care of themselves first, because if you can't be present, then you can't be present for the children. So, you know, I try through my charity to offer different services to our caregivers, even if it's like treating our foster mothers to the hair salon. We try to provide all of the Thanksgiving food needs. We work with a variety of sororities, Sigma Gamma Rho, the Deltas, Alpha Kappa Alpha, and they help us organize the food bank, and then the food is delivered to our families. To help them help the children, we identify age-appropriate gifts at Christmas, and, you know, some people might say, well, that's not a whole lot, but it's something. And
yeah.
I believe in taking care of your own corner first.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You said something that was powerful about when you're alone, the alone time.
Mm-hmm.
Brian and I, we were teaching Bible study a
mm-hmm.
couple of nights. Well, we did it once a week at the detention center. And we noticed that the kids they were so anxious to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And they would ask questions that would just blow your mind, because a lot of the questions they would ask, it's really simple questions that let you know that they probably never been in that type of environment.
Right.
Where a Bible and someone is teaching them, because they were asking questions like, what does God look like?
Mm-hmm.
Where does he live? Where is he? Why can't we see him? You know, they would ask those type of questions. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I wanted to ask you is, when you are in your alone time, we all have it.
Even as adults.
Yeah, right. And some of us have it right now, late at night. We have that,
mm-hmm.
that downtime when we are faced with life and what we're going to do, and should I give up or what should I do. Do you think that the woman that raised you, do you think that they helped you as far as give you the strength and courage to say, you know what, I feel down now, but I got
sure.
to keep going? Yeah.
Sure. I mean, we have to – a mentor isn't going to walk around with a placard around their neck saying, I'm your mentor. We have an obligation as the mentees to
yeah.
recognize when somebody's trying to teach us, and it's not always what we want to hear.
Yeah.
It really has to be about being open-minded and understanding that it's okay, we deserve to be loved, and sometimes a hug hurts because we're used to being angry. But we have to open ourselves up to trusting and to listening and to learning. And part of the learning for me was, you know, learning to appreciate the people and also to love myself. And not to look at the circumstances that I came out of as my fault.
Mm.
It's all very important.
Yes, it is. And another thing I wanted to say, too, you know, when we first got involved, I learned a lot, but I took a lot of hurt home with me, too.
Yes.
Because, I think that's one thing when people get involved, I don't think that they know the depths of what's really going on with these children, because a lot of them have been molested and raped,
mm-hmm.
and one kid, he saw his parents murdered,
mm-hmm.
and he was hiding in the closet. He was only about 5 years old. He hid, and the only reason they didn't get to him is because the gun that they was using, it didn't have a silencer on it, and it made a lot of noise. So they knew that they only had a couple of seconds or whatever to get out of the house, and he hid in the closet. He saw that. So
terrifying.
Yeah, and he is probably the meanest kid that you would ever meet. But before we finished with the Bible study, he was praying. He was leading in prayer.
Sure, because you're showing him that God is in him.
Yes.
That he has, he's part of. And when we are taught, that's part of the mentoring that we so richly deserve and need, that someone shows us or a group of people show us that we have it within ourselves, that we have something to offer, and that, you know, God is all around us and in us. And if no one teaches us how to pray to that and access that, how are we ever to know? So, you know, we need the mentoring. The mentoring is so very important. We have 513,000 foster children in care today, and the predominant population are African-American children, and beyond that, African-American boys who are in group homes. We really have to address all of our children, but we do have a disproportionate number of African-American children and Hispanic children in care.
You know, and I wanted to ask you about, you know, a little bit about that. Let's talk about, you know, the fact that we have such a disproportionate amount of African-American and, you know, minority children in foster care. And the fact that, you know, I know in my walk of life, I see these children and I want to help them, and there's not enough people out there that are foster parents, you know. Would you encourage, you know, and like I have three children of my own, so it's not really that easy for me to, you know, go and say, hey, I want to get this whole family.
Right.
You know, because at times I've had, you know, two, three kids in my home, you know, that were in the I was doing custody care, like when they were having an issue and they needed to do a quick placement or something like that.
But
they
placed
them in my home. You know, but it wasn't that easy to try to feed, you know, go from a family of five to a family of eight. And, you know, the state's not offering anything in, you know.
In terms of compensation.
Right, right. You know, you really do it out of your pocket. You know, and a lot of those kids would come and they would have nothing. I can remember one child, he had literally the clothes on his back, and they were too small. So we spent about $400 or $500 just so he could have shoes and underwear and at least a week, 2 weeks worth of clothing.
Well, I think that, you know, how people can help is, number one, some families have the ability, which is, you know, extraordinary, to take children in emergency care. But certainly with the Department of Children and Family Services, there is compensation involved for the care of the children. Of course, when I was in care, Agatha Armstead got $87 a month for my care. Of course, that is much different today, but not a whole lot different, but it's much different all the same. And there are purchase orders, annual purchase orders, which allocate funds for foster children to purchase their back-to-school clothing and ancillary needs. There are special needs children that the state offers a different compensation, a different class of compensation for special needs children, and those are special families that take those children in because tremendous amounts of patients are required to take care of our foster children that are special needs. There are a multitude of ways that we can interface. We do need foster parents desperately. I want to give a number for our listeners to consider calling. It's 1-888-799-KIDS with an S. 1-888-799-KIDS. They can also log on to fostercaremonth.org. fostercaremonth.org. And, of course, I'm a national spokesperson on behalf of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, Casey Family Services, and also work with Casey Family Program. But if you go on to, if you Google the Annie E. Casey Foundation. That's Annie, the middle initial E, Casey Foundation, or Casey Family Services. That whole organization will pop up, and they are an extraordinary national program that has committed themselves to families and children and the welfare therein. That was founded by the two brothers that founded United Parcel Service.
Mm.
A fascinating, philanthropy and entrepreneurship and what they did with that fortune, in part.
Yes. You know what, when you go into the foster care facility now, when you break that threshold or when you're on your way there, you know, do you remember the little Victoria that was scared and does it take you back when you were there, when you go in and you see that little girl that reminds you of you? How do you deal with that?
Well, I've been lecturing and visiting the children for 19 years. And now being on this New York Times book tour for the women who raised me, of course, the book tour is never about just going into bookstores exclusively. It's always about, I don't go on the road unless it has something to do with foster care, adoption, or children's issues, or it has to do with something in the book around what I do and what I come from. It could be about financial literacy and how it's attained coming out of foster care. It could be about women. It could be about the juvenile justice system. It could be about just about anything that attaches itself to the stories of the people in the book, because the book isn't only about my life. It's about two dozen other women,
right,
and other children that I interfaced with. What do I think about? I think about the best and strongest comprehensive message I can deliver authentically. And it requires honesty and openness and just putting it on the table. And I open the dialogue up to questions and answers, and I get all kinds of questions, and depending on who is in the room and the privacy of the group,
right,
we go pretty far.
Yeah, I know about that. Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's important for them to hear that you can overcome, that you don't have to be entrenched in shame, and that you need to practice reciprocity. That's a big part of my message, that as children they need to know now you've got to pass it forward.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to give back, because getting out of self is a healing mechanism for all of us. Being a service.
You know, it's funny because that's a big reason why Greg and I do what we do, because, you know, I know for myself, someone helped me when I was younger. You know, I came from that pretty much nuclear family, and then I faced issues of my parents divorcing, and I really didn't have a true role model to look up to.
Right.
And it was a good friend of my uncle's. I believe it was one of his best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked up to him, even though I had, several uncles, and, I had two big brothers, but I always looked to him, and I asked him about questions, to this day, when I do talk to him, I let him know. I said, man, you just don't know what you did for me when I was little.
Exactly.
And so, it's great that, we do teach them about reciprocity. When you learn something, give back to somebody. I always say give, the Bible says give and it shall be given.
Mm-hmm.
And so, even when I'm out there talking to people, I open a lot of myself up and the things that I've gone through, and the challenges that I faced and how I overcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we really have to teach that. We really have to teach that. And the other thing, of course, that was, important, really, I think really tantamount, was that I had an interest in something, and it happened to be creative movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so my foster mother recognized that simply because of the holes in my sneakers. She would say, why is it that you have holes in your sneakers and none of the other children do. Tell me what you're doing. Show me what you're doing. And when I showed her, I was trying to stand secretly up on my toes in the sneakers. She was amazed that I had an idea of what it might look like.
Mm.
And she taught me the 6 rudimentary steps of classical ballet from a book. She found a book. Only this woman would have gone to this trouble. And she taught me, as a senior citizen, the 6 ballet positions. And that's what I went to the audition with, without leotards, without tights, without ballet slippers. I walked into that studio, and that teacher asked me to show her. I had no ballet clothes. We didn't know what they were. And when I showed her that I knew these rudimentary steps of classical ballet with the arm position, she was amazed. She said, this child has a scholarship. And she asked me, how did I learn? And I told her from a book from my grandmother, because I didn't want to tell them my whole life story.
Right.
So I called Mrs. Armstead, my grandmother, in public. And we have to emphasize and underscore that people should not self-edit. I mean, I'm sure Agatha, after she had 10 children and grandchildren, great-grands, never imagined that she was going to be teaching me classical ballet in her living room. But she did. And that was the gateway, the ballet world was the gateway. So what I have to say is that children, we have to look, we have to help them identify what their interests are. In my case, it was a woman, one woman, the power of one, recognizing that the holes in my sneakers was something else.
Mm.
And that's powerful.
Yes, yeah. It is. I just wrote that to Brian, how powerful.
Okay. So the power of one, we have to encourage arts in schools. We have to encourage artistic after-school programs because that is the cathartic process that it's the only process that many of our youth have. You know, we're failing in schools. A lot of our children are being graduated systematically with a 3rd and 4th grade reading ability and mathematic ability. And we have to address this, especially in our urban and poverty-stricken areas where we do have high concentrations of foster children, and they're not getting the types of academic attention that they should. And fine arts are a way to teach them not only about mathematics through music and learning through dance and painting, and it's all part of the catharsis for inordinate pain.
Mm-hmm.
So I fight for arts, and Americans for the Arts is one organization that you can log on to, especially for grant possibilities. But Americans for the Arts is an organization that I encourage people to log on to.
Yes, yes. Mr. Royal, we have quite a few callers on the line, and I'd like to go to them. I'm sure they have some great questions for you.
Okay.
All right, so let's go to the caller in the 770 area code. Caller, are you there?
That's me.
Hey.
Hi.
Hey, Dee Stewart.
Hi, Dee.
Hi. My question is, I have been thinking about foster care or adopting for a while. Greg, as Greg and Brian know, I have postpartum heart failure, so I can't have any more kids.
Mm-hmm.
But I always thought about becoming a foster parent because I have a cousin. I had a cousin who was adopted into the family, who was a foster, who was in the foster care system, and I have a couple of friends who became
mm-hmm.
wards of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And
you were speaking earlier, right?
I was speaking earlier.
I heard. Yes, I was.
And I was a troop leader. A Girl Scout troop leader here in Atlanta where we actually support a children's shelter here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But what I've hear more of don't do it. It's going to be hard. They're even at an early age, they're hard and difficult to be able to be a parent to. And I don't want to believe that, but I don't know. I don't have any except for my cousin who raised my other cousin.
Well, I mean,
I don't have
children
much.
Are different. I mean, there are no two children that are alike, and just in Orthodox families or in the nuclear family, they have their issues, too, with their children.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we might not want to pigeonhole all foster children as difficult or all children as passive or what there it's a very blended group of children in care, and children come into care for a variety of reasons. They might have had corporate parents, maybe recreationally did drugs and found themselves addicted. So those children came into care. Sometimes children are orphaned and come into care due to a car accident or other. Some children are brought into foster care because of violence and neglect. And so there are a number of circumstances that bring children into care. And all the children obviously need different children need different needs. And every circumstance is going to be different. And sure, some of the children will need more than others. And sure, some of the circumstances will be much more challenging than others. But I would hope that during the training process, and once the foster parent in your case would be licensed, you would be very specific about what you can do and what you can't do. And I would like to believe that your request would be honored and respected. Like, for instance, I know foster parents that just take babies. They take babies until preemies, until they can be placed. So there's different ways that you can work with the system.
Yes, I know a particular foster family that only takes teenagers that are in high school.
See, that's amazing.
You know, and because those tend to be the hardest to place.
They are.
They say that they would focus on getting these kids prepared for the real world.
That's right.
Because what we know from foster parenting and, you know, being around foster parenting is that once these kids turn 18, you know, they're pretty much let on their own. You know, they give them a stipend if they meet certain requirements, but they really haven't been taught how to be adults. And because they've lived as wards of the state and they've been in that particular system for so long, if they didn't live with one particular family for a while, you know, where they could learn how to be a part of a family, they're pretty much still lost in the system.
20,000 to 25,000 foster youth emancipate every year, and where I've not seen the measurements, which is to say, I'm not trying to say that they don't exist. I haven't seen the numbers, but I would think because there is a need for family that there have been many foster children that have gone right into the military, seeking out more family. Because the military has that kind of attraction where you're a part of something.
Right.
And there's no telling how many soldiers have served who were in foster care. And those who come back and don't come back to family, and that's a whole other added complication because they have to work through that, returning home. So you're absolutely right. They do emancipate. A lot of our youth don't finish high school. There are stats. It's alarming what the stats are in terms of children who don't finish high school, much less college. And those that do get accepted into college and push the extra mile and might have someone pushing for them, but not in every case, we have seen where foster youth obviously get into college, but then some of them decide not to stay because they feel so out of their zone.
Mm-hmm.
They feel isolated. They don't have the social discretionary money to be social. You know, when you go to college, you might want an extra bit of change to go to the movies and go out, and there is no extra money.
Right.
So some of them feel so out of place and they're not mentored in that new experience. It's hard enough if you come from an Orthodox family. And these kids are doing it on their own, so
mm-hmm.
a lot of them drop out, unfortunately, after they've worked so hard to get into college. And so I always like to talk about mentors for college students, a place where they can go on the weekends. They have a place to go for holidays because we forget when we emancipate out of foster care, many of us don't have any place to go for Thanksgiving and Christmas and the holidays, and people forget we really do want to be a part of that Easter dinner, and we do want to go to church with the family. And there is some movement in these areas where host families identify the children. The problem is the children don't want to tell their business.
Right.
So then it's hard to identify unless they confide in a roommate or someone, and then typically a family from the friends ends up sort of adopting the child to participate.
If they're lucky.
If they're lucky.
Right. You know, and I remember the one thing that I learned when I was training to become a foster parent is that they said, don't get attached to the children.
I know.
And I'm thinking, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
How can you not?
Yeah.
You know, how can you say you're going to put your heart and soul into the life of a child and not attach yourself to that child, you know?
Yeah, well, that's antiquated thinking. I just never, I was with families that did not subscribe to that. Agatha certainly didn't. And I was loved. I can say that honestly, and it really made all the difference. You know, it just is necessary to be a part of life. And what happens is, if we don't teach love, how are these children supposed to love the children they have? And so what we've gotten into is a very dangerous cycle of babies having babies,
mm-hmm.
and those babies going back into the foster care system, and those teenage parents going on welfare. And it's a vicious cycle that has to be broken. And now with this new whole wave, this craze of teenage girls making packs, having babies, I mean, no one is telling these children that, okay, after you buy the cute Nike sneakers, because this is what I'm hearing out there, well, we want to buy the baby little Nike sneakers and little baby clothes, and so there's a living doll.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this obvious false understanding of what family really is, and that this is a serious matter, and that this is not a celebrity matter, because a celebrity sister had a baby.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So we have to really wrap our brain around what we're going to do about this new wave of what's considered cool.
Mm-hmm.
Because
what's considered the in thing to do now?
The in thing. And, you know, I don't know that every one of these girls that are part of this new wave getting pregnant are going to be able to keep those children ultimately. And were their parents ready to keep the children? And how many of those children are going to go into the foster care system?
Right.
We have a lot of work to do. But I'm hoping that at the executive order, when this presidential election is defined, that our president will put children at the top of the list and not at the bottom, if at all.
Hmm.
We'll put it back on its feet and put it where it needs to be, at the very highest level of consideration, with leadership like Marion Wright Edelman with the Children's Defense Fund, and Hillary Clinton, who's sunk in 30 years of her life behind effective legislative change, and people who really care about children in this country.
All right, we're going to go to the next caller, and let's try the caller in the 312 area code. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
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 How are you?
Good.
Well, first let me start by saying I just think you are the model lady. So I have always adored you. I just think you are fabulous.
Thank you.
So my question is, I'm actually I grew up in performing arts,
mm-hmm.
and I am an artist, and I teach art to youth through my church, and I mentor through the community. I'm in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond children that are in the foster care system, the average kid in our black communities in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
They're not in touch with the culture and their heritage, and the young girls are not refined. And I'm wondering, I just think it's fantastic that you've written this book, which I did not know about until today. And I've gone on your website, and I see you'll be in Chicago at the end of this month. Do you
now, where
have
am I going to be?
Oh, well, maybe it's not up to date. But
no,
just...
no, it is. It is. But I
okay.
travel. I've been on the road for 15 months. So.
Oh, okay.
You...
Well, July 23rd, it says you'll be here in Chicago at McCormick Place.
Okay. Well, now we're letting the listeners know.
Okay. I'm sorry. But I am have any plans to expand this vision, your vision, specifically your organization. Is there any way that the women here that I work with can tap into what you're doing where you are and bring it here
well,
to Chicago?
Well, sure you can. I mean, my idea is not novel. It really is about not reinventing the wheel. We have enough outlets to partner with. And so what I would like to see is if you could identify a perhaps performing arts school
mm-hmm.
and challenge them to give you 2 scholarships. Start small.
Okay.
2
mm-hmm.
scholarships. And if they say no, then don't let them off the hook. Say, what about partial scholarships?
Mm-hmm.
And have your church raise the other half of the tuition.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay.
before you do that, you have to identify the families. And when I say identify the families, you have to make sure that that foster parent or parent has the ability to get that child to the classes, because you don't want to set yourself up to fail your pilot.
Right.
You want to make sure that you have children that are passionate, and so are the caregivers,
mm-hmm.
because those are the kinds of parents I have. So you really can't do the Raoul Foster Children's Positive Plan unless the parents are intrinsic to its success. They have to get the children
mm-hmm.
to the classes. I'll find the funds, but you have
mm-hmm.
to show up.
Okay.
And that's important. So
okay.
I would start there.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many other ways that you can interface
mm-hmm.
with the community.
Okay.
You talk about the refinement of the girls. They have to be introduced to a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the media isn't showing them. Technology mm-hmm. isn't showing them. So perhaps it's something that you organize at your church and invite them to one Saturday.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great start, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're
welcome. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Yes, caller, thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
Victoria, it sounds like you're starting something here.
Well, you know, why not?
That's
I mean,
right.
everyone
right.
has something in their backyard to offer.
Yes, yes. I think when, and Brian can attest to this, and I know that you can, when you're talking with youth, you cannot sugarcoat anything with them because they can see it.
Yeah.
And they will cut you off if you're being fake with them.
Yes, they will.
I mean, they will cut you off to the point like, okay, it's like they're testing you. And that's something that Brian and I, we learned when we went in.
Mm-hmm.
They have this tough exterior up.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just being, you think they're being rude, but that's their defense mechanism. You know.
Exactly.
Yes. But once you get past that and they see that you're genuine,
mm-hmm.
they will cling to you, and you will see a love coming from them that's just it's amazing. I can't describe how awesome it is for one of the kids to let their guards down and let you in. But you also have to be remind yourself that I'm not going to let this child down, because if you do, he's probably not going to let anybody else in.
That's true. They also like to feel, I know how I felt. I really believe that part of my dancing success had to do with someone being proud of me.
Yes. Yes.
And whether it was my teacher, I wanted to do better for my teacher, and I definitely wanted to do better for my foster mother and how hard she worked. And you have to give a child a goal to work towards something. Very important.
Mm. And you're right. Go ahead, Brad. I'm sorry.
No, I was just thinking, you know, that was something that I've seen so often that when you finally give a child a chance, an opportunity to be who they think they are supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, I can remember there was a foster child that my mother-in-law had taken care of for a while, and when she arrived, she thought that she was a horse.
Wow.
You know, and people laughed, but that was her way of shielding herself. You would ask her a question, she would neigh and she would snort and everything else when she didn't want to answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she would talk normally, but when she got upset, she says, "I'm a horse now." And
mm-hmm.
she would start kneeing and weighing and everything else and galloping around the house.
Wow. Well, everyone has their own way of dealing. I mean, that was her way of dealing. Other people just shut down. Other people you act out in different ways. And,
right.
you know, I mean, sexually, provocative behavior, drug culture, I mean, and violence.
You know, and it was like by the time she left, you know, this child was just acting completely normal. She didn't want to leave, you know, but her foster family felt that she should be with, you know, and she was a Caucasian child.
Mm-hmm.
And so they felt that she should be with a Caucasian family versus a black family. You know, but to this day that child will call here and she still sees us in the streets and gives us the biggest hugs and tells us how much she misses our family. You know, because she opened up, because we showed her the love that she wasn't getting everywhere else.
Well, and then you bring up another issue around race and children. My feeling is that the idea of leaving a child, whether a child becomes a border baby in the hospital, border babies are children that are left in a hospital, oftentimes slipping through the cracks, or they're too fragile to leave initially, but then we find that the children are living in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a rarely spoken about culture that is going on. But in terms of the race piece, the idea of leaving children, whether in group homes or orphanages, people don't like that word, but we did have them, and because of their race, doesn't make sense to me, because love is love. And a baby is not thinking about what color you are when they need to be fed.
Absolutely.
When they need to be hugged, and when they need their diapers changed.
Mm.
So, and that doesn't go for babies. I mean, we all need love and we all need care, and that first 3 weeks is vital to our detachment and attachment issues.
Mm. Well, if you could give out your contact information. I guess they can go to your website at victoriaroyal.com.
That's right. It'll
yes.
link to the Raoul Foster Children's Positive Plan, and would love to hear from our listeners. I know a lot of the listeners are wondering if Drusilla's coming back to The Young and the Restless. And I'll just break the ice and say, you know, Sony Pictures Television owns the show, and I guess they will make that final decision. But you know, the most important thing to me is getting important stories on the air, and you know, the foster care adoption storyline has been running now for 5 years. And what I'd like to see Young and the Restless do beyond keeping that storyline running is to bring back the black family that once existed on that show.
Wow.
Since African Americans are the predominant population that watch The Young and the Restless, in the million, 25 million people watch that show a week.
Mm.
And we need to bring back the black family that represents the predominant population of people that watch the show.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I would like to see happen, among some other things, some diversity behind the camera, and then perhaps Drusilla could emerge. But you have to stand for something or lie down for anything.
That's right. That's right. Everybody in the chat room is going crazy.
you know, it's funny. Because when I told my mother that you were going to be on the show, that's the first question she asked. Is Drusilla coming back? I know she's going to come back and break up the wedding.
Well, you know, anything is possible, but I was always, tell mother that I was always about diversifying. I think The Young and the Restless is a fabulous show, but it's so fabulous that it really needs to get black writers on the show and black directors and black producers and a black hair and makeup team, and none of that exists. So I really want to see the show be all that it can be. It shouldn't be The Young and the Rest of Us. It needs to be The Young and the Restless and respect all of us.
But you know what? We knew. I was talking with Brian, and I said, Brian, you know what? Victoria looked like, she looks as if she don't play. She looks tough. You look tough. And you look, I mean, it's like, you know, a lot of people say we have what we allow ourselves to have, and you know, because we don't have this high standard for ourselves. And it just looks like you have that you're just not going to accept anything from anybody.
Well,
just any old thing.
You know, it really is about the women who raised me. And I can't have spent 18 years in a welfare system and not emerge as an activist.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really about, I've had 18 years in daytime. I'm trying to prepare for the next. And if I'm the only one marching, that's hard to bring about. So, you know, I appeal to all the listeners, you know, write in, youngandtherestless.com, and let them know that you want to see that family back together. Where's Mamie? Where's the father? Where's little Nate? Where's Olivia? Where's Keith Hamilton Cobb? Where is that black family that represents millions of black viewers that watch that show? Where are we? And why does everybody have to be mulatto to represent black? Don't get me started.
Oh, we won't.
I'm on that one. You know, I'm in the chat room, and one of our chat room friends is saying that they thank you for suggesting that they host a college student. I think you started a movement in our chat room here. Cause
good.
They're really talking about doing that.
Good. And not only a foster child, but understand, those of us who come from an impoverished background, we may not know which fork to pick up. And we need someone to remind us to put the napkin in our lap and for the gentleman to stand up and push the chair in for the lady. We need that mentoring, that refinement that the lady was talking about earlier. But somebody has to show us not to wear spandex, not to wear a belly shirt to the dinner, not to wear all the chains, and that's fine. It all has its place. But somebody has to show us boundaries.
Yes.
So help us, please.
Wow.
We'll do our part.
Okay.
Do our part. You know, we want to thank you again for coming on the show. It's just not enough time to talk to you. We'd love for you to come back sometime and just share, you know, your insights and the things that you're doing with your foundation. Because we think it is just absolutely wonderful and awesome.
Yes, it is.
You know, I want to thank you for having me on the show, and I want to do a shout-out to 100 Black Men. The National Conference just had me, and I also want to do a shout-out to the National Lynx Conference in Seattle, Washington. I want to thank the Lynx ladies for mentoring me. And 100 Black Men, I was a person that grew up fatherless, but I have to tell you, I was so embraced. And there was so much knowledge and wisdom and kindness and paternity in that room. I just want to thank both groups just recently, and the Lynx giving me that Elizabeth Catlett Award. It just meant a great deal. So I want to thank my community for embracing me.
Yes, yes. Those are two awesome foundations.
Yes, they are.
And great honors go to great people.
Okay.
You know, but again, VictoriaRoel.com. The book is called The Women Who Raised Me. Go out on Amazon.com. You can get it from the website, I believe, also.
It's on our site as well.
It's on
Barnes & Noble, Borders, and our black bookstores, please.
Yes.
Yes.
Books A Million. Thank you so much.
Oh, yes. We had a ball tonight. And, you know, I know that there's someone out here that listened to the show or will listen to the show tomorrow you know, through their MySpace or whatever, you know, get involved.
Yes.
What Victoria is doing is just so awesome and wonderful, and we need more people. You know, it's great when you have a celebrity that, you know, can do this, but we need the people right there in the local community to do it.
Yes.
With that being said, you've been listening to the Abundant Solutions Hour. We thank you, good evening, and God bless you.